Thank you for your attention. Green for Ford, this is welcome to the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act in a Comprehensive Climate Framework. I'm Harold Hedelman. Which is the green button for Forward? It's not. Oh, that one. Okay. There we go. I'm Harold Hedelman, co-founder of Business Climate Leaders, which is a CCL action team, which means you can join us on CCL Community. We planned this panel, and you can find out more about us on our website, which is www.businessclimateleaders.org. There we go. Well, I think that's enough for me. So here we are, working to enact a carbon price that will help leave our children the kind of climate we were given by our parents. We're working for a livable planet with a livable, restored climate. And I said help because even if after all your lobbying tomorrow, which I am sure will be fantastic, even after that, if Congress passes and then overturns a presidential veto of the EICDA, we won't be done. A carbon price by itself can't do it all. The EICDA won't pay for a new electric power grid or for farmers to farm carbon or for direct capture of CO2 from the atmosphere or many other things that we need to happen on the way to a livable, restored climate. This begs some questions for us. What is life after a carbon tax? What can we do now before a carbon tax is enacted? What other policies do we need to help every sector of the economy decarbonize? In Canada, the Pan-Canadian framework, which includes carbon pricing, is an example of a framework. So we might ask, what should a U.S. framework look like? This is not an academic question because, first of all, we need a plan soon. And second, finally, climate is a central issue now in U.S. politics. Our time for success is approaching. Just look at what's happening. The Green New Deal has galvanized climate discussions. The media is covering climate like never before. And we have presidential candidates almost daily coming out with new climate promises and plans. A lot of politicians have recognized, in addition to being essential, acting on climate is now a winning issue for them. This spring, Congressman Scott Peters posted a climate playbook listing some 50 pieces of pending climate legislation. Given all this, it seems like we're closer than ever to being able to make progress, but it won't happen all at once. Each chunk of legislation in our framework has to find the moment when its reason for being is recognized and its political stars are aligned. For the EICDA, let's hope that's tomorrow, thanks to you. But whenever, between now and then, legislators, NGOs, and the business community need to consider the kinds of ideas and solutions we'll discuss. And out of that discourse, we can create a comprehensive climate framework. Let's not repeat the mistake of the repeal and replace politicians who in 2016 took control of all three branches of government, but they didn't have a plan to move forward on healthcare. We want to be ready. So let's get started. Believe me, we have an extraordinary panel. Our moderator is Christina De Concini, Director of Government Affairs for the World Resources Institute. She oversees WRI's strategy on climate change and energy and represents WRI in high-level initiatives with corporate leaders. She led WRI's work on building climate resilience. And prior to WRI, Christina spent 2 decades advocating for the rights of immigrants and refugees, serving as National Director of Policy and Advocacy for several national organizations. Chris Adamo is Vice President at Danone North America for Federal and Industry Affairs, assisting the world's largest B Corp with strengthening the role of business in driving social and environmental good for all. Prior to that, Chris spent over a decade at the highest levels of the federal government working on issues related to agriculture, environment, and nutrition, and recently was the Chief of Staff for President Obama's White House Council on Environmental Quality. In 2017, he was a senior fellow at the National Wildlife Federation advising on sustainable agriculture, climate change, natural resources, and water. In addition to a law degree, Chris has degrees in economics and business. Katie Ott is the Director of Federal Government Affairs at Exelon. She's responsible for monitoring, analyzing, and advocating on energy, environment, and climate policy, as well as environmental rulemaking. Previously, Katie was a senior legislative assistant to Congressman Mike Doyle of Pennsylvania, where she covered his Energy and Commerce Committee portfolio focusing on energy and environmental policy. In 2011, Katie was chosen as a Bertelsmann Foundation Energy Fellow, and the focus of that program was increasing cooperation between the European Parliament and the U.S. Congress. And finally, last but not least, Janet Peace is the Senior VP of Policy and Business Strategy at the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions, C2ES. She manages some of the center's domestic policy work, its work on climate resilience, and its engagement with the business community, including C2ES's Business Environmental Leadership Council, BELC, the largest U.S.-based association of companies devoted to climate-related policy and corporate strategies, all of whom, by the way, support a price on carbon. Dr. Peace brings more than 25 years and a wide spectrum of experience on environmental issues to her work at C2ES. She has a PhD and a Master's of Science in Economics and an undergraduate degree in geology. So these are really amazing panelists, and we really are so appreciative of you being here. So two more things I want to tell you before I turn things over to Katrina. First, this slide, which will be available to you, has links to some of the documents we'll be referring to today. The second thing I want to tell you about is that I'm very pleased to announce that I'm helping launch or relaunch a new CCL action team focused on climate restoration. And feel free to contact me afterwards if you're interested.
Okay, thank you so much, Harold, and thanks everyone for being here. We don't have a long time, but I was asked to I just want to do a couple really quick slides. I'm going to just run through them about where we are in terms of carbon emissions and where we need to go, which ties directly into what the topic of this panel is, that we, WRI and everyone on this panel, I think, but I can certainly speak for us, believe that a price on carbon is essential cornerstone to solving the problem, but it's not going to be enough by itself. So just as a start, the latest IPCC 1.5 degree report tells us that we need to reduce CO2 to net zero by 2050 and engage all resources at a significant scale. So the next slide is the good news slide. Renewables are growing really, really fast. The next slide is the bad news slide. Atmospheric CO2 is continuing to increase at a really rapid rate. This slide is interesting in terms of another bad news slide, that the growing energy demand is continuing to be met primarily by fossil fuels. You'll see that little tiny green bit is the green. Green is wind and solar, and then hydro and nuclear. So we have a long way to go. And I'm going really fast over this. We could do 2 hours on any of these, but modeling in the U.S. By 2050, throughout a variety of reports from the Obama administration mid-century target report, risky business, UCS, Union of Concerned Scientists, NRDC, and a number of other studies on electricity, and in 2050 show that, in fact, renewables will be the majority of the electricity, but only up until a certain point, and all of them end up showing the similar results, that we're going to need all forms of, like, all hands on deck. We're going to need CCS. We're going to need existing nuclear. We're going to need to remove carbon from the air. We're going to need everything we can, which is why it's critical that all the work that you're doing, and my hat's off to all of you to try to get Congress to enact a price on carbon, is incredibly important. And so the conclusion is that we need to do everything. I won't go through all the things, but we can't just put all of our bags in one basket and say renewables will do the whole thing, even though we do tons and tons of work on renewables and love them, but we're gonna need energy efficiency, we're gonna need to harness a market, which is what you guys are working on. We're gonna need to continue to build renewables, and we have to build transmission, et cetera. So with that, I'm going to turn to our panelists. And any of you can jump in if somebody's saying something really interesting that you want to interrupt. I'm all for it. So I want to start first, though, just before we move into what complementary policies our esteemed panelists believe that we need in addition to a price on carbon, I did want to hear from each of them from where they work and where they sit, why in your you know, in your business or your perspective, is the price on carbon and the bill that you guys are all pushing such an essential piece to solving the climate problem? So we'll start with a quick there, and then we'll move into the additional policies.
You want to just go down the line?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm Janet, and as you heard in that intro, I'm an economist. So how many of you in here have heard economists talk about carbon pricing? That's why I'm for a price on carbon. No. Seriously, it's a way to stimulate the market. It's not government picking the right technologies. It's sending a signal so that people know to put that in their decision making. They think about, okay, this price is going to affect me, and I'm going to change the kind of technology that I'm going to put into place. And we all know that innovation is important for addressing climate change. So pricing continually rewards innovation. The cheaper you can do it, the better it is. And economists will tell you that pricing is the least cost way of achieving an environmental objective like reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, if you can reduce at a cheaper cost, you can do more and you can do it sooner. So from an environmental perspective, it's effective. It achieves the end goal, and it stimulates innovation.
Chris Adamo with Danone North America. It was mentioned on the onset that I work for the largest B Corp in the world, and I want to do a quick definition of that and then lead to what we've been up to. I don't expect anybody to know what B Corp is or what B Lab is, which is a third party that certifies and verifies such business or corporate organizations. About 2 years ago, Danone North America made a couple changes. We purchased a company called White Wave. We became a much larger U.S. company, frankly, with a number of different food brands and commodities supply chains feeding those food brands. We took that opportunity to reorganize from our corporate structure. We became a public benefit corporation. And legally, what that means is that we have a fiduciary duty that is broader than just to our shareholders. We're letting our shareholders know that we want to work with stakeholders at large. And so for us, that means sustainability, nutrition, and that's in our corporate papers filed in Delaware. About a year later, we were fortunate to be certified by B Lab, a nonprofit, that we reached B Corp status. And that just means that we hit certain scores on how we govern as a company, how we work with our community and workforce, and then thirdly, our environmental performance. So all very fun stuff. It's about continuous improvement too. Every couple of years we'll be reassessed on how we're doing. So a lot of this work for us is about climate change, and it's about how we operate across our footprint, at our facilities, at our transportation sector. But most importantly, as a food company, we have commitments down our supply chain, which means down to the farm level. And so this is very unique. Why do we do that? We see risk, number one. We are a global food company. We source commodities from across the world. We're primarily a dairy company. We have a number of dairy products, Danone yogurts, Oikos, things of that nature. But we also bring in things like chocolate, things like sugar from abroad. So we have a worldwide sourcing system for a number of our worldwide brands. As you can know, there's significant risk across those different regions. And even here in the US, we look at, look what's happening right now in just the Midwest, for example. We've had significant rain, significant floods, some quite damaging, in fact. Just this past week, I mean, we literally have folks looking at how many acres are being planted in Ohio, in Indiana, in Michigan, and Iowa, for example. That affects the price of the feed going to our cows here in the US. That's just one example of why this risk matters to us. But we also see opportunity with climate policy. I mean, so we look down our supply chain, how can we decrease that risk? How can we improve resiliency? How can we improve efficiency with our farming partners that supply us? And then on the other side of the coin, obviously we care about our consumers. What do our consumers think about our brands and our different products? And so diversification and choice is really important. So we think we offer a variety of healthy foods. Yogurt is a very healthy product. Fluid milk, like Horizon Organic, very healthy product. But we're more and more also offering plant-based products. So things like Silk and So Delicious are offering almond milks, offering coconut milks, various plant-based products. We think both have a very sustainable place in most consumers' refrigerators or cabinets, but choice and innovation really are opportunities here, and climate is often a driving factor for us in thinking about what new products we want to offer. So a number of different ways that we as a food company look at the climate risk, but also climate opportunity.
Finally, I'm Katie Ott with Exelon Corporation. I just want to make sure I say this right at the outset. Thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for being here. As Harold mentioned in his introduction, I used to be one of those folks on the Hill that you all will be working with and meeting with tomorrow. And I just cannot say how important it is to have the effort like this. It really is extraordinarily impactful. So thank you all for taking time out of your lives to come do this. And in answer to your question, Christina, I think I'll just tell you a little bit about Exelon, and I think it'll become pretty apparent why we support a price on carbon. Exelon is a large energy company. We're sitting right in the middle of the power sector. That's our main business line. So we own and operate 32,000 megawatts. We have the cleanest, lowest emitting fleet of the top 20 power generators in the country. We produce one of every 9 clean electrons that is put on the grid in the United States. We have the lowest carbon emissions rate of any other energy supplier. And this is due in no small part to conscious decisions that the company made way back when the company was formed. We made decisions to invest significantly in our nuclear fleet and in renewables and in some natural gas as well, and completely divested of all coal. We also own a company called Constellation that provides retail energy contracts. So when you hear about renewables contracts for a lot of corporate businesses that are interested in pursuing some of these, our Constellation business line sets up a lot of those contracts. So we have companies like Starbucks and McCormick, the spice company. They do a lot of their renewable procurement through our Constellation business. And finally, we own 6 utilities across the United States. So these are what we call T&D utilities, transmission and distribution. And those 6 utilities are in primarily metropolitan areas, Chicago, Baltimore, Philadelphia, here in Washington, D.C., southern New Jersey, and Delaware. So that's Exelon in a very, very brief nutshell. And so you can see why we've been supporting climate policies for a very, very long time. We've arrived at sort of the same determination that Janet was talking about, which is this is the fastest, most efficient way to get to the clean fleet that we want. But we also acknowledge that there are other policies that need to be enacted and worked on, and we, you know, support lots of climate policies that are before the Congress right now. But a price on carbon is something that we think, especially in the bill that you all are here working on, that's refunded to customers through a dividend, that really gives us the greatest impact to our clean energy fleet, while addressing utility customers' needs as well and making sure that they're not disproportionately impacted.
Thank you all. So I always think, first of all, I want to say thank you to all of you too, but I think it's really useful for when you're going to make a case before somebody in a congressional office about, you obviously know for yourself why a price on carbon is so important, but it's great to hear from businesses, economists, et cetera. So the next question is really getting at what this panel is really about, and that is to ask each of the panelists to talk about some of the additional policies that they view are essential to getting getting emissions reduced at the right rate that we need. And particularly, I wanted to, Janet, if you can make sure you touch on some of the difficult to bait sectors and explain why we need additional policies. Chris, whatever you want to talk about on land sector or anything else. And Katie, the one thing that you just said that if anybody else wants to pick up on is, it's terrific if any of you want to talk about any things that are currently pending in Congress, like you mentioned, simply because it will make all of you a lot more informed if you're able to say, well, yes, I know about this storage bill, and that would obviously be an additional thing we need. So with that, we'll go down the row, but anybody can jump in if they want to add on something.
Well, I'm going to add on that I think it's amazing that you guys are here. And, you know, when you go to the Hill, they're like, as an economist, they're like, oh, yeah. Don't talk about elasticity to me, but they want to hear from you. They want to know why you're volunteering your time, why you're here. And I think you can be so impactful on this topic. And now to get to your question, because I want to make sure I add to my thanks. So there are a lot more market failures than just this externality we call carbon pollution. So strictly from an economic perspective, we need other policies. We can't just do it with a carbon price. It just is not going to be enough. For example, we need innovation and we need new technologies. Well, there are market failures with technology that you need other policies to address. There are political economy issues. For example, if the carbon price is too high, we're not going to be able to get it through Congress. And we'll get a lot of pushback. So putting a price that incentivizes us to switch our cars, that would require a really high price. A different policy, like CAFE, can be market-based, not as part of a carbon tax or a carbon price, achieve the same objective without the same kind of pushback you might get with a super high carbon price. Carbon price really needs to be durable. Policy needs to stay. We can't have one that's on again, off again, as Harold was saying, because that really doesn't provide an incentive for my friends over here to be able to invest in those new technologies. If you don't know what's going to happen in the future, why are you going to put that money into a piece of technology or into a facility that's going to last multiple years? You have a lot of uncertainty. So durability is super important. So policies that fix market failures, whether they are like technology or like buildings, for example. Some people own them, some people rent them. So there's this owner-operator problem. So you need a different kind of policy to address that. So building efficiency standards are a very effective way of doing that. We just came out with a report a couple months ago, near-term policy recommendations that we think that you can get through this Congress. I mean, we, of course, really support a carbon price. It's been, as Christina said, a very much of a cornerstone for us when we were the Pew Center and now as C2ES. But there's some things that you can get done now because we don't think that it, I mean, hopefully you can be very effective tomorrow and get these guys to push it through. But on the off chance it doesn't work, there are some things that can happen today, even as you set the foundation for next time. So complementary measures in all kinds of different areas. One area that I think Christina hit on here, carbon capture and storage. We need some technology to push and pull that into the marketplace. It's getting better. It isn't far in the future. But there are uses for that carbon that we need some incentives for, RD&D. I think that's probably enough.
I think I'll take a couple approaches on this. One, Danone has been very engaged on this conversation internationally for some years now. This is not a new conversation for us. So what that has meant as we were part of the Paris Agreement conversations, like many other companies, frankly, we obviously weren't the only ones there. We continue to push national commitments across the board so that Paris is implemented. We have spoken out here in the US, to this administration, asking them to stay engaged and continue the US commitment. That will continue to be a longer conversation, unfortunately. But those international pieces are very important. And you may hear this, some of this tomorrow when you're meeting with certain offices. They may want to know, well, what do you think about China? What do you think about India? What do you think about Paris and the possibilities there? And you know, my recommendation is, unless you're an international expert into it, I don't know that that's your job to get into it, but I think you can reference the fact that we are trying to implement, we are trying to engage, and we are trying to make, this is going to be a long-term effort from a number of different perspectives. But that is still very much an alive conversation, even though sometimes it gets relatively pessimistic here in the U.S. Secondly, in the food sector, we have tried to work with other companies to identify what are the various pieces of U.S. policy that need to be identified by Congress or by this administration. And when I'm going to talk about these, I don't necessarily I'm not advocating that they need to be all wrapped up in one bill, for example. They could, but they don't necessarily need to be either. There's a number of different ways they can be approached. In fact, I would argue in some cases, the government's actually started down that path, perhaps in the last administration, and even in some cases this administration, from an agricultural standpoint. So just a couple of quick examples. Danone, with some partners in the food sector, Nestle, Unilever, and Mars, for example, with Sustainable Food Policy Alliance. It's a new initiative we launched last year. We put out some principles on policy about 2 months ago, and we identified, number one, price on carbon is first and foremost the most important thing. But we had laid out five other principles in addition to that. Clean energy development and research, for example, infrastructure that is resilient and able to withstand, or perhaps even climate smarter in some cases, maybe even be able to bank or use natural systems for infrastructure. We also looked at, you know, issues of equity and making sure that any policies that's implemented thinks about the various different communities that it may affect, and also just regulatory synchronization, right? There may, again, there may be multiple issues, multiple regulations or laws that we need to get to where we need to be. Let's make sure that they're working together. So those were just some of the high-level principles we put out. They were not policy specific. Our approach thus far is to just enter into a dialogue and educate and make the business case about why these things are important. And we'll obviously get into various policy details as we go. But let me go back to the agricultural and land sector real quick, because it's something that is very, very pertinent to us as a food company. We have anti-deforestation commitments worldwide, which is a whole conversation that we could go down to separately. But just thinking about agriculture, for example, and just in the U.S. here, where we work across, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of acres, thinking about the grain that is feed that just goes to dairy cows, for example. And we think, and it's not just us, but there are a number of different stakeholders that are engaging in some very collaborative, useful discussions to think about, well, you know what, U.S. agriculture is roughly, depending how you count, 8-10% of overall U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. Someone correct me if I'm off. I know it gets presented in different ways. So, yeah, it depends how you count. But there have been some really positive, optimistic recent analysis showing that just with today's technology, today's best practices, we potentially could reduce that by almost half or roughly half. Just using things like cover crop and no-till and better nutrient management, looking at carbon, looking at nitrous oxide, looking at methane as a holistic systems approach, whether you're a corn soybean farmer or the dairy operation itself, for example. So we're engaging in that. Looking at some futuristic options that are being researched and starting to pilot, we think we might even become a carbon net zero bank here in the U.S. from a U.S. agricultural perspective. At least we think that's something to shoot for. Whether it's achievable or not remains to be seen, but that could be a long-term 2050 play. So what does that mean for policy? Very, very high level. Research is still needed. We're doing some decent research right now across our land grants, across the Department of Agriculture. Some significant investments have been started over the last 5 to 6 years. We have climate hubs across, I believe, it's 6 universities right now in the U.S. There could be some improvements. Funding is always going to be short. We always need more funding. Probably some better coordination amongst that research in order to identify what is low-hanging fruit, what are the long-term priorities that we can be shooting for. And frankly, getting some of it applied, actually engaged in pilots, is always a struggle. We work with Cornell, for example, to use them as our scientific basis when we're talking to our farms. We have a soil health pilot that we have about, at the end of this year, we'll have in the neighborhood of 43,000 acres enrolled in that pilot, where we're doing benchmarking and we're starting to do interventions on those acres to track and monitor and verify what the greenhouse gas impact is. So thinking again, just research overall, data management, data collection, data modeling at agriculture is very important. These are dynamic systems. They fluctuate a great deal. It's just taking those holistic approaches on a corn soybean farm, say where I'm from in southern Michigan, versus that same type of operation in Iowa, you may have different impacts based on climate, based on soil type. These are very dynamic systems. So data collection, data management, modeling improvements are needed still to get that confidence and precision that we want in measuring. And then finally, incentive to farms. Even when we make the case to our farms that there's a long-term benefit to doing these activities, it's still a short-term cost to them. So how do we get over that short-term cost in order to realize that long-term benefit to both the farm and to companies like us? We're still proving that out. And that really gets back to the data. We're making the case. We're developing the proof points. The U.S. government is doing that. more with us, and not just us, but there are other companies, other nonprofits engaged, a whole host of actors across the country on the ag side. But there still could be some help from a policy perspective to really corral this and frankly amplify and scale it up larger.
Well, so while I've been sitting here, I just jotted down a quick list of the policies that I have been up on the Hill talking about in the last month or so. And this is not an exhaustive list, but just to give you an example of the many policies that are being considered right now on Capitol Hill that are not a straight price on carbon, but have a lot of beneficial impacts. There's a storage ITC, so this is a part of the tax code that would apply a tax credit to battery storage. Technologies. There's a nuclear ITC. There's clean energy standards. There, in the transportation sector, there's an electric vehicle credit and CAFE standards that were mentioned earlier. Building and appliance efficiencies, weatherization policies, and of course, innovation and R&D. So that's just what's been going on in the last couple months that I've been up on the Hill talking about with different members and different staffers. But I really just want to focus on two that I haven't even mentioned yet that are very important to Exelon and something that we're spending a lot of time on in addition to our advocacy for a price on carbon. One is to stem the premature retirement of our nuclear power fleet in the country. Two is to really focus in on climate resiliency policies. So the first of those, the loss of our nuclear fleet. Obviously, Exelon owns a large portion of that in commercial markets. There's lots of policies impacting that that we can talk about. That's flooding of cheap natural gas into the markets is affecting the economics of some of these plants and other similar programs. But at the end of the day, we're ending up with a good portion of our nuclear fleet that is what we call, quote unquote, at risk. And this is at risk of premature retirement. So nuclear plants are licensed for a certain amount of time, right? You have to go to the NRC, get your operating license, and you do that for a certain number of years. Most of these plants that we own are licensed, which means the NRC has certified them for safe and secure operations through almost the mid-2030s, a couple year difference for each of our plants. What's happening is that we're announcing the retirement and the closure of some of these plants today, even though they are perfectly fine and safe to operate until well into the 2030s. So a third-party report from a group called Scott Madden just put out a report that says across the country, the at-risk premature retirement of our nuclear fleet will be 47% of all carbon-free resources in the United States. So that turns into what we call a give-back of about a third of vehicles on the road today as far as carbon emissions are concerned. So it's the equivalent of about 100 million cars. So if those plants actually do shut down, you're getting the carbon emission give back equivalent of about a third of the vehicle fleet that's on the road today. So even under NREL's most rosy predictions for renewable build out that we hope will happen in this country, we're not even gonna be treading water when it comes to carbon emission reduction in this country. To bring it a little bit closer to home, in the power market that we operate in, which is PJM, recently there have been some of these announcements of closure of these at-risk plants in Pennsylvania and Ohio. It's about four plants in total. If those plants actually go offline, and one is already announced and set to close in September of this year, if those plants actually go offline in the next couple of years, as they have been announced to, they will be eliminating all of the renewable build-out in all of PJM that has ever happened. It's gonna set us back 25 years. So I just say that because this is a real problem that we have to address, because while we have to be massively building out our renewable generation in this country, we can't just be treading water. We want to be building upon the zero carbon resources that we have now. So a lot of this right now is being done policies at the state level. But in addition to that, we're working on some policies at the federal level, including, I mentioned, a nuclear ITC, which is a part of the tax code that could go to some of these nuclear power plants. So that's one complementary policy we're working on. The second one I mentioned, resiliency policies. So we've all read or seen or been familiar with the National Climate Assessment that came out. Christina mentioned the IPCC report. While we're all working very hard towards mitigation policies and ways to reduce our emissions currently, we have to be realistic about the impacts that are happening right now today. This is happening at our utilities. We own utilities in the Midwest that are experiencing a lot of this flooding. We also have utilities on the East Coast that are making different considerations about how to build out infrastructure based on projected sea level rise. And the issue is that Congress and the federal government hasn't actually addressed resiliency in a comprehensive way since the 2005 Energy Bill. So in 2005, they passed this thing called EPAC 2005, and there was a big resiliency section in there. But that actually had mostly to do, it was a response to the 2003 blackout, and it had some transmission policies in there. But there hasn't been really a comprehensive federal response on climate resiliency since then. Lots of different agencies within the federal government have looked at resiliency and have proposed different policies, but nothing comprehensive. In fact, if you go look through what's out there today, you'll see that 16 different agencies, federal agencies, have addressed resiliency, each with a different definition of resiliency. So what we're really trying to focus on, while, again, we've got to be able to walk and chew gum here, we've got to stay focused on mitigation and reducing emissions, we also need to have some more clear guidance from the federal government about climate resiliency policies.
Okay, thank you very much. So two things. I'm going to just add a couple points on what we just talked about, and then I'm going to combine two questions, and you guys can answer one or both or neither, just because we want to sort of wrap up in about 7 minutes to let everybody else ask questions. So one takeaway I just want to make sure people are walking away from what people just heard here is that I don't think anyone expects tomorrow for you to be able to talk about, they do expect you to be able to talk about the CCL bill, but all the details of what these other policies are. But they're important for a lot of reasons. Some of them, nuclear and CCS, have more Republican support as well as Democratic support. You have Senator Whitehouse, who's a huge climate champion working on all these issues. So that political lens is an important thing. I also wanted to just say a couple really, this might be really basic, but I think it's important because sometimes you hear people say, well, we'll take a price on carbon as long as we could just get rid of all the regulations. And some regulations under some circumstances might be duplicative, but like Janet said in transportation, there's lots and lots of people that drive the same amount from some rural area to their job, and they drive whether gas costs $5 or $2. They don't have an option to just, and if there's a price on carbon, they can't just stop driving. So that's why in certain sectors, we're going to need a lot of additional policies. And we're working on a lot of the things Chris mentioned too, to get data collection on soil and carbon in soil, which is because the land carbon issue is a really significant one. That isn't going to happen just because there's a price on carbon. But the government's going to need to appropriate and direct studies on that so that we can figure out how to do cover cropping and all these things in the best way. Also in the IPCC report, it talked about that it's very likely we're going to overshoot our carbon budget and we're going to have to remove carbon from the atmosphere, both through the natural solutions that we can do a lot more on that Chris mentioned, as well as investing in new technologies. And I just want to say one other thing that is often so misunderstood on the Hill. Our government has always picked winners and losers. That's how we get new technologies off the ground. That's how fracking happened. It doesn't just happen because the private sector just suddenly decides to invest some enormous amount of money not knowing what the outcome is. That's how we got oil out of the ground, which at the time seemed like a very, very promising thing to invest in. That's how we got roads, there's the internet, all sorts of things. So I would just caution you in terms of, there's always that pushback, but that is sort of the way we get big things done in this country, whether it's going to space. We couldn't have done that just by waiting around and hoping it happened. Okay, now, that's the end on that part. Now, here's the two questions. So, and they're not really related, but it's a time crunch. So There is a lot of great stuff going on in the States, despite this desert or backward sliding phase that we're in here in the federal government on climate. A lot of really good stuff. And so if any of you want to discuss how those state programs could or would interact with, supplement, complement federal programs, I'd love to hear any on that. And then I'm combining it with a second question to leave people with some sort of inspiration, and that is all of you work in Washington, are super knowledgeable on these issues with tons of Hill experience and really tied into the politics, and just sort of what your assessment is today of the momentum in general now that we're have kind of the Green New Deal and we're finally on the agenda again of Congress, the assessment of, are we close to any tipping points? Do you think we're actually going to get to see action sometime soon? And I think, so answer either one of those briefly or a combination, and then I want to open it up for questions.
So I'm going to take your second question, which is about the momentum, because I do feel like I've been working on this topic for a long time, but I do feel like we're kind of on the cusp of really making some significant progress. I mean, you mentioned the states. There's the U.S. Climate Alliance, and you probably know there's like 24 states that have joined that. And in that alliance, all those governors have agreed to implement the Paris target. So targets, pretty cool. And we're not just talking about coastal states. Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Nevada, Minnesota. So that's very cool. You've got the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who has not been a super friend of us that have worked on climate change for a while. But they did issue a statement, and it said, inaction is not an option. Mm-hmm. I like seeing that. The National Association of Manufacturers, similarly, positive on taking action on climate change. We've got Republicans putting their names on bills. We haven't seen that since the last major push on a comprehensive climate bill. So I actually think we are on the cusp. Again, hopefully you can make some progress tomorrow. You go. But setting the foundation, I think there's a lot of momentum, and I do think the time is right for you guys to be up there, and I think we have some promising outlooks in the not-too-distant future. Let's hope.
Great. I'm just going to quickly feed off that because I worked in Congress back during the last debate, 2008, 2010, roughly, and we spun a lot. We did. I think we met during that point. We were optimistic, especially when President Obama came into office, and there was a ton of energy, just a ton of optimism. It was a very exciting time, and then also a very disappointing time when it came crashing to an end. So we kind of experienced both ends of the spectrum of emotion. But looking back, which is now 10 plus years, it could not be more different right now in terms of the energy and atmosphere of the dialogue, of the debate. There are just so many new people and new interests and new voices at the table that did not exist, frankly, 10 years ago. You all being case in point. I wish you were around 10 years ago. It would have been a different conversation. The companies like the Danones of the world honestly weren't at the table, at least in the same way. So there may have been some examples of companies. I know Exelon was in some very really important corporate dialogues, but it wasn't the same as is right now. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, we had 75 plus companies in D.C. advocating for a price on carbon. That we were one, I mean, that just didn't happen 10 years ago. So to Janet's point, the list is long about the difference between now and 10 years ago. That doesn't mean it's going to happen. That doesn't mean it's a slam dunk. But it is a very different discussion. And so I think that is I'm not going to assess what the likelihood is or when it's going to happen, but I do think in the next year to 3 years, just to take a quick stab at a time frame, I think we'll start to see some various movements. And it may start slow. It may be piecemeal at first. And then maybe we can get to a larger discussion on price on carbon, or maybe the price on carbon happens and then we fill in the blanks with some other pieces. I think Washington, D.C. can be an incredibly pessimistic place. There's a million excuses about why Congress won't do something. If you start from that basis, nothing's ever going to get done. But Congress also has a very long track record of actually passing legislation when there's a true emergency and when there's a true grassroots. If you have those two things and those two criteria met, the chances of passing a bill are much, much improved.
I think I'll just say ditto to wrap it up, I actually think these two questions are very related, both state policies and momentum. I just wanted to point out that we have today 29 states, the District of Columbia, and three U.S. territories that have passed some kind of either RPS or CES, so a renewable portfolio standard or a clean energy standard, or some other major kind of climate or energy policy. And I think that's really pushing folks here in DC. I think these members of Congress are seeing what's happening back home in their states, and they're seeing that momentum in the states, and that they're picking up and moving forward and not waiting for the federal government. And that's really pushing a lot of members here. And then just ditto to everything else that was said.
Okay, fantastic. Well, let's open it up to questions. I'm not sure who's, there's somebody doing the mics here. Yes, please. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, just tell us your name, where you're from, and then questions rather than like long paragraphs are preferred. Okay? There's many hands back there.
From your experience on Capitol Hill, how would you each assess the effectiveness of a year-round stream of phone calls to members of Congress?
I'll be very quick, because I used to get this a question like this often. It all matters. It's an all-of-the-above strategy in communicating to your legislatures. Number one, it's got to be authentic. It's got to be real. They get listened to. So a phone call or an email, a lot of offices will keep an Excel sheet, and they'll tab how many folks, what city, what state. Obviously, they're going to count their state and probably not others. So be from that place, be from that district, be from that state, and it will get heard. It doesn't mean you're going to move the needle just by that one call, but in the aggregate, it all very much does matter. And the one thing I'll just say to your visit tomorrow, find a reason to follow up, especially in the states and towns that you're from. If you can just do a thank you, if you can provide maybe an invitation to an event back home in the district or state, all of these things are really, really useful tactics to keep that engagement ongoing. So if it's a phone call every week, that's great. As long as it's legit and you're putting your authentic voice on it, it will get heard. But I would think broadly about what are the various tactics and how can you bring other folks from your state and district into the activity as well. It really does all matter. It's pretty incredible, actually, at the end of the day.
We have a lot of hands. Okay, I guess.
There's one over here.
If you would like to point to them, we can.
Pardon me?
I said, if you want to point to who you'd like to pick.
I don't. Just anybody who has their hands up. There's a lot of people with their hands up.
So. Okay, right over here.
Great.
All right, Peter Joseph, Marin County, California. I was a pretty avid anti-nuclear activist after Three Mile Island when I was young. And at COP21, when I heard the climate scientists led by Jim Hansen basically pleading to keep the existing nuclear power fleet operative for the reasons that you cited, I've completely changed my mind about that, and I hope that they stay open. We have Diablo Canyon going to close soon, and the San Onofre plant has been replaced by natural gas, methane. So my question is, this seems way too important to be left to the investor-owned utility business, and is there a chance that the feds would step in and say, no, you can't close that perfectly fine nuclear plant ahead of schedule. And my guess is they would probably like some financial support if it's not financially profitable to keep these plants going.
Katie, that's you.
Yeah. Great question. Thank you for the question. Essentially, what is the federal government's role at this point in stopping some of these at-risk plants from?
Why are they closing? You answer that. That's what's.
It's a case-by-case basis. I mean, I can't answer that for every single plant that has announced, but I can say that, as I mentioned before, there's a certain number of aspects, including very low natural gas prices in these energy markets, including some policies that credit other zero-carbon resources but not nuclear, and then just some other kind of market attributes. That's not a solid answer for every single plant has its own story. Anyway, as far as the federal question, yes, we think that there is a role for the federal government to play here. I mentioned the nuclear ITC. That would be a federal piece of legislation. It's actually modeled entirely after the solar ITC, which is a tax credit for that kind of zero carbon energy. That's just one of the ways, one example I can say that the federal government could get involved.
Terrific. Hi,
George Kralovic from Annandale, Virginia. Building on what Peter said, we're hearing now more often that existing that renewables will not be enough, and we'll need to accept existing nuclear to meet the needed reductions on the scale we have to reduce. But on the other hand, that most of these estimates, while that's encouraging, that we might stop shutting down plants that are perfectly good. That won't be enough, that we will need, because of the huge growing demand in the emerging economies for energy, we'll need not only existing nuclear and to stop shutting down plants, but we'll need a massive buildup of nuclear. I challenge anybody to read a book just out by Joshua Goldstein and Stefan Quist, who recently presented at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the argument very convincingly that existing nuclear will not nearly be enough in addition to renewables, and that the demand for power by the emerging economies will require a massive buildup of new nuclear plants on a scale and a speed that was done in Sweden, and a scale and speed done in South Korea, and nearly done in France, where all three countries are nearly powered completely by clean nuclear. So can you comment on that, anyone that's familiar with that argument in that book?
Okay. Why don't you comment first?
Okay. I think you may have answered part of your question there. I mean, we do need new advanced modular nuclear reactors. And there's a lot of cool technologies and a lot of people working on this. But one thing you didn't ask about is carbon capture, use, and storage. And so in addition to nuclear, there are some sectors of our economy, for example, steel, for example, cement, that we can electrify them, but that's really not going to be enough. We also need to be able to capture the CO2 that comes from the production process. So we're also going to need carbon capture, use, and storage. We need to protect the old nuclear. We need to get new nuclear, we need to get the cost down so that it is easier to compete, and we're going to need some incentive to do that, and we need carbon capture, use, and storage. So just to answer.
I have a question.
Questions?
Yes. My name is Ron Marshall from Petoskey, Michigan, and my question is the use of seaweed for cattle in order to reduce methane.
So I'm going to answer this probably not 100% satisfactorily. I don't know the science exactly on that particular method. I'd have to check with my team, to be honest. It's one of the many things that we and others are looking at in terms of livestock nutrition. So I'll just say more broadly, there are a number of different technologies, food additives, nutritional techniques being looked at right now as a part of dairy cow and, frankly, even beef cattle nutrition. So there's a number of things out there. It's a little coincidental. You asked that question to me because I literally just asked someone on my team, I think it was last week, Thursday or Friday, I said, because I had encountered a technology provider of that. It wasn't seaweed, but it was some other food additive. And I basically asked my team, I said, do we have a checklist that we've kind of gone down and analyzed the different folks? I mean, there are people out there selling these things. I mean, there are business opportunities trying to sell to farms such as what we work with. I think we're still assessing the pros and cons of these various techniques. Some look promising, and others have a lot of variables to them. So seaweed could be an answer, but there's a lot of different pieces being looked at.
Okay, let's take from this woman here, but then somebody back here that woman. Okay.
First of all, thank you so much for your comments. I'll definitely be using them tomorrow with my members of Congress, and I appreciate the context you give me as I advocate for the price on carbon for the next, hopefully no more than a year. My question is, would Danone and Exelon be willing to endorse HR 763 as a part of a comprehensive solution set?
Yeah. So I can say that we have endorsed a price on carbon in many different forms of legislation. And let me just say that I know it's important to endorse a specific bill with a specific bill number. I guarantee if tomorrow you're up on the Hill and you reference Exelon's support of a carbon price, there's going to be a lot of staffers who are very, very familiar with that. We absolutely have supported CCL's work. At this point, we understand that CCL wants to continue to be a grassroots organization, and that's absolutely appropriate and a great approach. But we have joined the CLC. There's a lot of C groups on this issue. The CLC is a business organization that supports a price on carbon. This is the one that's the $40 price on carbon that's also refunded through a dividend. The bill you're going to be up advocating for tomorrow is a $15 price on carbon that escalates at $10 a year. Essentially, the two bills kind of get at the same place.
No, they don't.
And I look forward to being educated on that later.
Okay. So I want to.
We've been asked for our endorsement on that bill and have provided it.
Can I jump in just real quick? So one thing I've noticed on the Hill is these bills change, and I think the CCL bill is amazing, but next week there'll be a different carbon pricing bill, and you want to make sure that you're not dissing every other bill that comes up because they are going to change. So that's my one piece of advice.
And from a Danone perspective, I mean, we're happy to keep talking about this and learn about this bill. Frankly, we do need to learn about this bill more. But again, we need to engage in a lot of different conversations. And frankly, right now, we are just most interested in talking to the Hill, talking to stakeholders, and saying, look, there is a real business case for having a price on carbon, for having federal policy. So it's a dialogue right now that we're interested in building, and we want to build that coalition to have the dialogue so that we can ultimately assess the various different approaches out there. And we haven't reached that assessment point yet, but we are very excited. And we need these sorts of proposals, so congratulations and thank you for that, and definitely willing to work with you more on it.
Yep, go.
Yes, my name's Mary Francis, and I'm from Oklahoma, and we are concerned about fourth generation molten salt power. I was so glad to hear you speak about nuclear. That is one of Jim Hansen's issues, and it was the fourth generation. This is not your old water-cooled uranium-plutonium generation. This is a totally new way of generating power.
Can I just ask you to get a
And I am
question.
Hoping that someone up there can speak to the fourth generation molten salt power plant benefits.
Okay. I'll just say this. Exelon is certainly aware of MSR technology, has lots of really smart folks looking at it and looking at different national labs that are doing a lot of research into that. Very supportive and excited. That goes back to, again, what we were talking about when you're up on the Hill tomorrow, the R&D and innovation aspect. Talk about DOE funding, talk about the Office of Nuclear, and that's a way that you can support all of those policies as well.
Okay, we probably only have time for one more, I think. But so great, two more, okay, great.
Can you hear me? Oh, can hear me. Warren Beaton, Northern Virginia, Haymarket. Going back to nuclear question for a moment, assuming carbon fee and dividend is put into legislation, or carbon price of some type is put into legislation soon. First of all, two questions. How permanent is the nuclear shutdowns, and what basis do they have for being reinstated if the carbon price gets, when the carbon price gets high enough, and what kind of a higher price is needed to make them economical?
Thanks, all great questions. There are certainly things that we've discussed. The sooner the better as far as advocating for a national price on carbon. As far as your question about can these things be brought back, the answer is no. As soon as a nuclear plant is shut down, it immediately goes into a decommissioning process, which is completely overseen by the NRC, as it should be, and there's an entire process for that. But it's unlike a gas or a coal plant that you can do this thing called mothballing, where you turn it off for a couple years and maybe wait for prices to come back. You can't do that with a nuclear plant. So it's fundamentally different, and it really just speaks to the urgency of everything that you all are doing here.
Can I just add one little piece to that? Everybody always asks, what's the price? But you know, if you're an investor, you don't need to know exactly what today's price is. You need to know in the future that that price is going to go up so that you have some certainty about what you're going to invest in. Because those plants, Katie, how long do those plants last? Oh, you know, 40, 50, 60. They last a long time. So it doesn't have to be today's price, that $15 escalating at a predictable rate. There you go.
Okay, we're going to do one more. Okay, that's the last one.
So I feel very fortunate to live in an area where we have nuclear as our primary electricity source. So we already have a 91% fossil fuel free electric grid, which means that our emissions come primarily from heating our buildings and transportation. So the idea of beneficial electrification is really a priority for us, but it's something that most people have never heard of and don't have a clue about. So do you have any suggestions for policies that could promote beneficial electrification?
I have a lot, but I feel like I've been talking a lot, so I want to give an opportunity. So here's what I say about beneficial electrification, obviously something that we're very focused on as well. Yes, we need to electrify huge parts of our economies, probably starting with transportation, but also buildings and everything else. Here's the trick and how I explain it on Capitol Hill. Sometimes we'll have some pushback on beneficial electrification because people say, well, wait a minute, aren't you just plugging into a dirty grid? Is that really what you want to be doing? No, of course not. But we don't have the luxury of waiting anymore to get these electrification policies after we clean our grid. So they need to be happening at the same time. So I like to say, as you've got your carbon emissions from your power sector coming down, you've got to have your electrification policies building up at the same time. And there's going to be a point where it starts to all make sense, but we just don't have the luxury anymore to wait until we completely decarbonize the power sector to then start on these electrification policies. So as far as advocacy tomorrow, I would encourage you to remind folks that we need to be working on these things at the same time.
Okay, great. Thank you so much to all our panelists, but mostly thank you to all of you, really, for your time, your resources, your passion, your commitment, the fact that you're here, it's fantastic. And I think that the theme of this is we need everything. We need all hands on deck. We absolutely need your bill passed and many other pieces of this. And the only way to do that is for your voices to continue to be ones that Congress hear from all the time. So thanks a lot.